Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Georgia Gilholy is one of the younger generation of journalists. With a Jewish background and as a former feminist, she found herself inexorably drawn to becoming a Catholic. As an undergraduate, she read history and then became increasingly interested in politics and political commentary. She's now a reporter with the Jewish Chronicle, a columnist with Conservative Home, and a political commentator for a wide range of outlets. As a freelance, she's written for the Times of Israel, Lone Conservative, the Jewish News Syndicate, the Imaginative Conservative, Common Sense Network, The Critic, The Guardian, Spiked Online, Speak Freely, Allgemeine Journal, The Article, Backbench, and Broad Online. She's also an editor-in-chief of the Foundation of Uyghur Freedom. And to talk about her journey as a journalist and into the Catholic faith, she joins me now.
Georgia, thank you so much for joining me today to have a conversation. You have a Jewish background and you've become a Catholic by choice. Can you tell me something of your journey into the Catholic faith?
I think in terms of my background on a day-to-day basis, it's probably similar to the vast majority of children in Britain growing up in the 2000s. So religion was never part of my life in any shape or form. I have some very fuzzy memories of at school doing maybe the Harvest Festival or something like that. A few RE lessons, learning about Passover. And that's pretty much it. So in terms of what I thought about religion, God, etc. I mean, I would say for a while I didn't really think anything about it because I was a child and it's not something that I encountered as part of my life. And I suppose when I got to sort of the age where you began to read the news and that kind of thing and form your own opinions on the debates of the day, I sort of automatically was quite atheistic in my approach to things. And I would say probably until I was around 16, 17, I would have identified as quite a militant secularist or atheist.
Splendid. So you're an archetypal secular, product of a secular culture with nothing in the Well, that makes it all the more exciting. I mean, I got inoculated, so it was, I think, harder to distinguish between bad religion and the authentic kind. But you came from a tabula rasa. Well, so what was the catalyst?
When I was around 13, as I said, I began to become interested in kind of political ethical debates and have my own sort of, probably then I thought they were brilliantly articulated opinions, but really they were just sort of quite embryonic. And I think, interestingly, one of the topics that led me to, I suppose, start encountering religion and religious arguments from religious people was probably questions around abortion, because of course, we know in modern Britain, it's been legal for quite some time and it's very, you know, socially acceptable. And I accepted that when I learned to know what it actually was when I was like, you know, 12, 13, whatever, probably from watching, I don't know, some kind of soap opera or something in the background while I was doing my homework, as many of us do as teenagers. I automatically was in favour of it because I saw it as... I suppose I automatically assumed that it was empowering to women and it was all about choice. And I think many people, because they're going about their everyday lives, they don't necessarily have time to listen to the Catholic Herald podcast or sit there reading dusty tomes of philosophy. They don't necessarily question things that are morally acceptable.
Choice and power are both very heady concepts and deeply attractive at first sight until you look beyond them, which, as you say, most people do. So that's how they came to, of course. How did the mists begin to clear?
Actually, reading about the topic and about the ethical arguments for it and it being presented as something that was, like I said, about choice, freedom, liberty. And I just noticed there was a gap in terms of talking about the dignity of the unborn child. And I think in terms of people being pro-choice, you could probably maybe divide them into sort of three camps. And I think the first one is, as I was saying, just everyday people who understandably don't even think about the issue and don't want to get involved because it's seen as a religious thing, which actually it's not. The second camp is people who I suppose are more activist about it, but they cloak the language in lies and innuendo. Things like, lots of American actors will say things like, oh, this is a procedure that should be safe, legal and rare, and then are happy to go on the soapbox and argue for abortion up to birth. We know already that that's something that is legal in the UK for babies who have any form of disability per se. And then I think the third camp is people who are pro-choice activists and they are honest about it. When I was at university, I was involved in the Libertarian Society. I would no longer really identify as a libertarian, but it was definitely a great experience to be involved when we hosted lots of interesting debates. And so one of the debates we had was on abortion, and we had the former CEO of BPAS, Anne Purady, who you may have heard of, and a lady from Ireland, who I forget the name of, but she, I believe, was involved in a pro-life charity. And so Anne Purady is very open. She admits that, okay, abortion is the ending of a life, and I think that it's the right thing to do because I believe that usually social concerns of the woman outweigh the value and the dignity of the unborn child. It's like, okay, if you're going to be honest, we can actually have a debate. But that's not happening, unfortunately. And I think that if you were to bring this up in a conversation with the average group of people my age, it would instantly become very emotionally charged. And it's just difficult to actually get across your point without maybe people thinking that you want to oppress people.
There is an argument to be made between potentiality and present status, so to speak. And one's entitled to make it, but not many people think it through. And it's also not particularly clear how to range one's ethical priorities. But as you say, there's a debate to be had. And then if one has at least has the debate, one can explain one's working and what one's priorities are. Ultimately, that will expose one's moral hierarchy. But it is extraordinary the way it becomes charged. Why do you think it has its, you know, rationality suddenly evaporates in the face of emotionally charged anger and fear?
I think on the whole, people probably, their instincts on this are right. And I think that they may have a naturally pro-choice inclination because they think about the extreme cases of, let's say, a woman has been raped, basically.
Sure.
Not a nice word to say, but the world's not a nice place and it happens. And I'm sure probably everyone knows someone that it's happened to, even, unfortunately. And we think about those extreme cases. And we think about people who might be in terrible situations, be they financial disarray, that kind of thing, or people who maybe they've gotten pregnant and they don't want to have to look after a baby, which I think all of them are understandable. However, in terms of the ethical arguments, it doesn't necessarily mean that an unborn child is not a life. And I think that in terms of actually how the laws happened in the UK, I believe the idea initially was that this was going to be something that was very limited. However, once you open that watershed, there's no going back. You can see that now because things like contraception are as available as they could be, you know, anywhere in the UK. They're either cheap or free. However, I think a third of all pregnancies in England and Wales ended in abortion, which is insane. We're talking about First World War levels of population elimination. Whatever you actually think about the ethics of abortion, that is pretty alarming.
And the same thing applies to euthanasia, of course. At the moment, you make arguments for it. If it was just me and nobody else, I would make some very cogent arguments for it. But I know perfectly well that's an unsustainable position. And anyway, my own convenience is not the most important ethical precept. But we know perfectly well the moment you open the door to it, it will reach exponential proportions. So how did changing your views on the priorities of the pre-born child move you towards being a Catholic?
As I say, first, I was encountering these ethical issues. I was, I suppose, finding holes in some of the, I guess, general arguments, but I suppose they're by default secular arguments because they're not attached to any particular theology or even philosophy, to be honest. I think most general public opinions, there's not necessarily much substance to other than social convention a lot of the time. And I think that when I began to encounter these things, I realized that, let's say if we're saying all human beings are equal and they have equal dignity, equal right to life, etc., etc., why is that? Because so many civilizations, ones that exist now and ones that have existed in the past, do not hold that. And I think it's something that actually instinctively lots of people in the West do hold. And why is the reason for that? It's because of the, I suppose, leftover elements of biblical morality that linger on in our laws.
This is a Tom Holland argument, isn't it? That actually we're swimming in Christian waters in a Christian goldfish bowl. It's just that people don't know it, but that if you were to take them away, in particular contrasting them with the world of Rome or Greece, then the ethical presuppositions we live by are Christian. But it all comes down, seems to me, to be the sanctity of life. The more I think about this, the more the whole thing focuses on the genius of Christianity and Catholicism, which is that life is sacred and we have absolutely no moral basis to take what we can't create. And that is simply an absolute moral position. And from that flow all the virtues of the dignity of human being and a good deal of the freedoms. And you may not be a libertarian, but nonetheless, the liberties we enjoy all flow from that too. I don't see any other system. I'm not even humanism, which is really quite relativistic in its choices. No other system prioritizes the sanctity of life in the way that Catholic Christianity does, do you think?
I agree with you. In terms of modern humanism, I'm actually very unclear as to how it operates, what its system of beliefs are, and that's probably because there isn't necessarily a divine set of principles other than, okay, we don't believe in Christianity, we don't believe in Judaism, we don't believe in Islam, whatever. However, we would like to create this club of people who basically believe in being nice. What is the reason for being nice? Oh, because
well, absolutely, it's a parasitic choice of the nice. It's all founded upon Christian principles, which they want to accept where it's convenient without the metaphysics. But as you quite rightly say, with some kind of nice outcome, the preference is the person who holds the views, and rather like teenage girls and abortion rights. There doesn't seem to me to be a lot of secondary thought or thinking through the principles. And emotion begins to emerge the moment you begin to introduce the notion of God. So if it is about the sanctity of life, again, what propelled you towards the Catholic Church?
As I said, when I was growing up, religion wasn't part of my life at all. However, at school, I obviously studied history and I began to study it more and I actually ended up doing it at university. And before I was sort of, I suppose, 17, hadn't really studied any sort of pre-early modern history. And I hadn't particularly studied anything about the history of religion, apart from, you know, the very, very basics. At A-level, we did the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, Catholic Reformation, Catholic Renewal, however the historians would like to define it. I know that's a huge debate. And at university, I sort of went a bit more in depth with that and began to study the past. I found it utterly bizarre how this is something that we didn't encounter in school really whatsoever. And I think really that just speaks to, unfortunately, the decline of our curriculum. We're really not encountering our own past to the extent that we should be. And I think people just don't really understand anything about, I suppose, the history of England, Britain, but also the world. They don't understand their own culture, but they also don't necessarily understand others. So their responses are quite ad hoc to everything.
It's true, but I had a very good, an extraordinarily good education and thought I was going to be a historian initially. I wanted I studied law, but I wanted to do history and fell in love with history. And I got on reading history because one does if you're interested in it. But the thing that's really blown me away in my 60s is to discover that all the history I read was anti-Catholic history. The whole modernist view of Europe, it seems to be have been captured by an anti-Catholic, either secular or Protestant bias. And it was only when I became a Catholic and I began reading people like Eamon Duffy, who offer a sort of a form of, I wouldn't say, if I say Catholic revisionism, what I really mean is, I think, telling the truth about it, but revisionist in the sense that the prevailing culture has simply been anti-Catholic. You know, you keep on discovering people, well, saying, well, actually, there's no difference between the Elizabethan era and Mary's era. They killed about the same number of people. So
me and my brother like to have that argument.
Right. Well, until you come to the Elizabethan state and the length of time and the vicious absolutism of Elizabethan politics sustained brutally over a period of decades. I'm not going to defend what Mary did to the Protestants, but when the two projects just aren't the same. And again, you're entitled to make a choice, but one shouldn't imagine that in a simplistic level, it can just be done by counting the numbers of people who lost their lives. But the point being, I've just been astonished to encounter Catholic history, and particularly the Catholic Reformation, and discovering that Protestantism and the so-called Reformation led immediately to, of course, atheism and humanism and the corruption and breakdown of the sort of independent worldview that we've that has grown straight out of it. But none of this is available in school, and I suspect that not much of it is available in the in the history faculties at university either.
I suppose I share with you the fact that I believed I would become a historian and that I did not. It was definitely the correct choice, and I find actually I'm learning so much more every day just working as a journalist, so that was definitely the correct decision. And as you say, in terms of what is given on, let's say, the required reading at university and what is taught in lectures, seminars, on the face of it, I would say it certainly is not something that would propel you to consider becoming Catholic. Due to various reasons, I ended up exploring, I suppose, writers, people like Eamon Duffy, as you're saying, outside of that. And also literature, writers like Evelyn Waugh, of course, I'm a huge figure in literature in the 20th century, and obviously a convert to Catholicism. And also a very specific thing that I suppose led me to probably look more into it was in studying the 16th century, you obviously encounter the conquest of America. Of course, a huge question that comes up with that is, they're deciding, should we enslave these American Indian people? Do we consider them equal to us? And of course, the people who are lusty for getting these huge estates and trying to get gold and trying to make money, of course, their argument is, yeah, you know, sure, they're inferior to us and we can do what we want. However, in terms of the actual theological arguments, there was a huge backlash on people like Las Casas were making essentially arguments that were based on medieval scholasticism, Catholic theology, as to what on earth are you guys talking about? These crimes are horrific, and the reason why we can't simply go around enslaving people is because every single soul is equal and every single soul has dignity, and forcing people to do your will is fundamentally anti-biblical. Obviously, the question of slavery right now, in terms of the history of European empires and slavery, is obviously a huge controversy right now. But really, it's been the history of it and how it happened. It's been a controversy since it began.
There was a wonderful order formed, I think, in the 15th century. And I wish I could remember the name of it, but I've only just come across it, which was simply formed in order to raise funds to buy slaves for their freedom.
I didn't know that. Wow.
No, it's very exciting. I was reading an article on the Catholic Church and slavery, which was essentially saying, of course, that really from the patristic era, the arguments were made in terms of the dignity of humanity, the image of God, that the whole church was despite the fact that, of course, Paul accepts Roman overlordship in the ancient world, of course he does. The early Christians were not in a position to establish a form of social revolution. But the moment the Christians began to construct society in the light of the principles that flow from the incarnation, the Catholic Church began immediately to support the freedom of human beings not to be enslaved by each other. And just to discover that an order of monks emerged in the early Middle Ages in order to redeem slavery, I thought, exemplifies beautifully the Catholic Church's commitment to the sanctity of life. But it's one of the things, you know, I'm quite well read. It's taken me towards near the end of my life to even discover that. And so most people just take second, third, fourth and fifth hand history at the most superficial level and construct it according to the given prejudices of the culture they live in.
What you were saying also about history, I suppose, being quite hostile to Catholicism, I think that that's an example of that. But at the same time, something that we see emerging and people probably wouldn't even realise necessarily that it's anti-clerical, anti-Catholic, whatever, is a view that I would say it's common on the left and the right of politics. And probably on the right of politics, you're thinking more, I guess, the liberal free market type people. But that really is the majority, I suppose, when it comes to people who are in think tanks, whatever. And this view is, of course, that it's sort of constant progress. And I think that the Age of Enlightenment is a huge moment in that worldview. They see it as entirely a positive thing, the destruction of obviously traditional monarchies in many places in Europe, and essentially the first sledgehammer taken to religion. Because really, after, let's say, the 18th century, of course, most people were still fairly devout, especially compared to now. However, in terms of the intelligentsia, the people who are making great works of literature and that kind of thing, more and more and more of them were becoming people who were quite radical, revolutionary, and they certainly didn't have the typical Christian worldview that people had before that in their approach to things. And I think that it's very easy to, for example, when people make arguments for freedom of speech, primarily people on the right of politics in our age today, they often say, trying to, let's say, cancel a debate at university, this is backwards, this is medieval, and we need to return to these Enlightenment principles of reason, rationality, freedom of expression, etc., Areopagitica, prejudica, blah, blah, blah. However, I think that that is a very surface level view, and you can see how it is, because anytime you really see a group of people try to approach things purely through the idea, okay, we're all going to agree on free speech, even if I'm a communist and you're, I guess probably fascists wouldn't be allowed in it, which is a good thing. but I'm, I don't know, a super true Catholic, and then someone else, I'm an anarchist, whatever. We're going to have this group and we're going to agree on freedom of speech and rationality. What's your definite rationality? Where does it come from? From whence did it emerge? Your rationality is different to my rationality. I might say, okay, freedom of expression is acceptable up until this position, let's say inciting violence. And I think that the Enlightenment is really not a good foundation to base your moral political movement on, because it is incoherent. And the idea of it really is, it's almost, as you're saying, quite similar to the humanist worldview. It's people taking some people, because obviously the Age of Enlightenment was a huge and very complicated process, and you have people who are far more extreme and people who are a bit more moderate, and people who were trying to, let's say someone, Immanuel Kant, but he was someone who in some ways was trying to sort of take Christian type principles and justify them on a natural, secular, philosophical basis.
And it doesn't really work, because...
No, it doesn't work. And I think we're seeing that.
We certainly are. Apart from the notion of a freewheeling rationality being in some way answerable to a free-floating ethical hierarchy, it simply is, it doesn't work at all. But I think the problem with the left is it's based on this notion of progress, which is like completely fallacious. Two fallacious notions. This is the Rousseau idea that human beings are blank slates and you can write anything you like upon them if you only do your education properly. And the other notion of progress. And I can't see how anyone who's looked at the history of the 20th century can retain a vestige of an ideological commitment to progress, because we may have technological progress, but that's not really what people mean or think. And I wonder what you think about the idea that, which I'm just beginning, I think, to have to come to terms with, that to be a Catholic is inevitably to be placed on the right, on the grounds that, although Peterson's very good about talking about the way in which you need to both conserve and reshape, because conservation leads to entropy sometimes and has to be shaken up. But at least in the terms of our culture, almost all the left-wing radicalism is utopian and secular and rationalistic, and effectively either anti-religious or anti-Catholic in its expression. I mean, there's very little radical impetus from the left that is not anti-Catholic. Are we not faced in a position where we just have to own the fact that what we're trying to conserve is what remains of Christendom, because without it, we're just going to find ourselves swept into a Huxley-esque or Orwellian culture? Isn't all this an argument for saying we should not be embarrassed to be on the right as Catholics?
I don't think people should be embarrassed. However, I think that it's almost as if you're sort of being defined externally if people believe that just because you have I wouldn't even say a traditional Catholic view, just a coherent and devout view, someone that is actually a practicing Catholic, they have the Catholic quote-unquote view on things, they must be on the right because they, let's say, they think, you know, abortion is wrong, or they think that we should preserve marriage, blah, blah, blah. I think it's almost like we would be defined externally. And I think that in terms of the left being communist, socialist, or the extremes of socialism, I think that, of course, that is something that is incompatible with Catholicism, or really most religions, because it treats humans as malleable. And in terms of how those ideologies actually play out as well, when certain groups and governments try to enact them, it often ends up millions of people being used as cannon fodder, basically in a utopian project. And Christianity is fundamentally anti-utopian. However, I think, of course, intellectually, culturally, the right has degenerated as well, but also the left. I mean, think about 100 years ago, or maybe a bit more than 100 years ago, in terms of, let's say, the British Labour Party, it was far less radical than some of the socialist movements on the continent. And at the same time, it was drawing from a wealth of Christian communities in Britain. There were people from nonconformist movements, there were lots of prominent Catholics as well. And I suppose the idea from that is really that lots of those people, they believed in the dignity of labour, which is also, I suppose, a Christian perspective. And they wanted better working conditions, that kind of thing. I just think that sadly, that's been lost because those communities have been lost. They really don't exist anymore. I think that's very unfortunate because I think previously there was a coherent Christian tradition on the left, and that simply has vanished, at least in this country it has.
It has completely, hasn't it? There's a last question. Let me ask you, as a journalist who's become a Catholic and finds himself on the right, I'd rather not talk about right and left. I think they're impositions deriving from the French court that are completely unhelpful to us, in fact, but we have to use language other people understand. I'd rather use Catholic and non-Catholic. But as a Catholic in journalism, are you afraid of being cancelled? How are you going to manage the slings and arrows of outrageous trappery that identity politics is laying for us all? My sense is the chicane is getting narrower every day and every week. You've become a Catholic, you're on the right, you're a journalist. How are you going to avoid its cancellation?
Well, first of all, as you're saying, I would agree with you that definitions of right and left, I at this point wouldn't even necessarily subscribe to, but sure, define me as on the right, I really don't care. In terms of being cancelled, quote unquote, I think everyone is sick of that word, to be honest. So me personally, it would be quite difficult for that to happen to me simply because I'm very open about what I think and it's not like I would be trying to hide anything. And at the same time, a lot of the work I do is on issues that are not necessarily always discussed in polite society anyway, and for publications that wouldn't necessarily want to blacklist me for writing about those topics. They would, in fact, welcome me to writing about those topics. I think, let's say I went down a different path, and as soon as I left university, I'd applied for a grad scheme at a national newspaper, and that's what I was doing right now. That would be a very different thing, because let's say I was on the editorial desk or the opinion desk, and I wanted to write something myself, and it was an opinion that people at that newspaper wouldn't necessarily welcome and it didn't really fit the editorial line. It might be that they simply wouldn't run it, or let's say they did run it and it created a huge controversy, or let's say I did run it, there wasn't too much controversy, but it meant that my colleagues were hostile to me because of it. I think there are definitely situations like that happening, and I think that probably less of them are happening because people just don't feel comfortable maybe sharing some of their opinions. And I think, of course, I think people can sometimes get too in their head about some of these things, and I think they lose the ability to distinguish what is legitimately being cancelled and it's not just that that's happening, or what is actually someone's behaved inappropriate work or that kind of thing. You know, social stigma exists for a reason. But the problem is that the people who are often involved in some of these, I suppose, cancellation campaigns, piling on people for having an opinion they deem to be immoral or inconvenient, I think that often they don't actually admit that's what they're doing. And they say, okay, this is just a natural social corrective. They say this is just consequences for your actions. Okay, but I can disagree with the shape of those consequences.
And perhaps as journalists, one of the things we can do most of all is try and expose the double thinking and the prejudices. And so in that way, to do something to diminish the power of cancel culture. Georgia Kilroy, thank you so much for spending this time with me. It's very kind. It's been a great delight to talk to you.
Thank you.
And all the best with all the work you do. And thank you for joining the Catholic Herald on this particular podcast. Bless you and thank you.
Thank you.